Solve, secure, protect. Look to Patel for the independent thinking and cross-disciplinary focus it takes to advance security and safety in a changing world. They provide their clients with integrated solutions that secure our nation and help solve challenges within infrastructure, environment, emerging threats, and deployable mission-ready technology. Their teams leverage their deep expertise to develop science and technology for a healthier, safer, and more sustainable world. Visit Patel.org to learn how Patel makes the impossible possible. Welcome to From the Crow's Nest, a podcast on electromagnetic spectrum operations, or EMSO. I'm your host, Ken Miller, Director of Advocacy and Outreach for the Association of Old Crows. Thank you for listening. In today's episode, I'm very excited to be joined by Congressman Jim Langevin. He is chairman of the House Armed Services Subcommittee on Cyber, Innovative Technologies, and Information Systems, also known as the CITI Subcommittee. Before we begin, I would like to thank our sponsor, Northrop Grumman Corporation. Northrop Grumman provides full spectrum superiority. Their innovative, multifunction, interoperable solutions ensure warfighters have full spectrum dominance to make real-time decisions no matter the environment or domain. Learn more at ngc.com/EW. I'd like to welcome Congressman Jim Langevin to the Crow's Nest today. He is a senior member of the House Armed Services Committee, and as I mentioned in the opening, he is also chairman of the CITI Subcommittee. He is actively engaged on a range of technology issues, including electromagnetic spectrum operations, directed energy, and cybersecurity. He represents the 2nd District of Rhode Island, and he is in his 11th term in office. I've worked with his office for several years now. He has always been one of the most approachable members of Congress you'll find on Capitol Hill. He has a tremendous personal story of overcoming a tragedy of a gun accident when he was 16 years old that left him paralyzed, a quadriplegic. And he's used this to become a strong voice on a range of issues outside of national security as well. So I greatly appreciate the job he's done, and I'm so happy to have him here with me today. Thank you, and welcome, Congressman Langevin.
Thank you. Thank you. I find these issues all very challenging. And at the end of the day, the more I understand it, hopefully, the more I can do to help strengthen our national security and give our warfighters every advantage so we're never sending them into a fair fight.
Excellent. So I want to start off, talking about the House Armed Services Committee. You are the chairman of the Subcommittee on Cyber, Innovative Technologies, and Information Systems. And this is a new subcommittee this year. You were formerly the chairman of the Intelligence, Emerging Threats, and Capabilities Subcommittee last year. And so HASC kind of basically redesignated that old subcommittee and broke it into two, and you have the what we call the CITI Subcommittee. And then the other one is, I guess, Intelligence and Special Ops. I was wondering if you could walk us through the rationale for breaking apart or redesignating the IETC committee from last Congress into these two new subcommittees, and what is the role this new subcommittee has, and what is your jurisdiction?
Yeah, so the rationale behind the changing the subcommittees and having two is that the subcommittee that under the current jurisdiction is with the cyber and innovative technologies and information systems is growing in importance and capabilities, and it didn't seem to be slowing down anytime soon. And we need to be able to give the attention, the focus that these issues really deserve. And last year's NDAA, by way of example, had over 70 cyber provisions in there, so much so that we had to create a new cyber title in the bill for the first time. There were also dozens of AI provisions, and our success in great power competition really relies on sophisticated, coordinated digital capabilities. So HASC needs, I believe, dedicated staff and resources to face this challenge and exhibit the oversight of our men and women in uniform that they deserve. And again, our goal is to try to master these technologies, identify where we have an advantage as a country and grow that advantage. But remember that also our enemies and adversaries are investing heavily in technology and their electronic warfare capabilities to undermine our advantage, where we've made such heavy investments over the years. And we need to identify where they have undermined our advantage, and we need to turn that around in our favor. Again, we should never send our warfighters into a fair fight, and that is our goal. So
Yeah. So, well, I wanted to, you know, quickly, you know, build on that. You've had a number of interesting hearings to start off this Congress, one on electromagnetic spectrum operations. You just had one on disinformation warfare ideas and cyber. Heading into this year, particularly with an eye on the FY 2022 defense budget, what are some of your specific priorities that you're looking to direct the subcommittee's attention to?
Well, so we have jurisdiction over cybersecurity, cyber operations, and forces. We're going to focus on artificial intelligence, machine learning, information technology and operations, software acquisition, electromagnetic spectrum and warfare, and science and technology. So those are the areas of jurisdiction under the subcommittee. I'm particularly interested in, obviously, cyber and both offensive and defensive capabilities, but directed energy is another thing. I believe that directed energy is at an inflection point, and we've got to do more to get it out of the labs and into the hands of the warfighters. And then the electromagnetic spectrum related issues. Again, those are the areas, that, especially EW, where we make use of these extraordinary, exquisite capabilities, very heavily technology-centric, but and given our warfighters amazing advantages, everything from whether it's ISR to the sophisticated weapon systems that we've developed, even cyber capabilities. Our enemies and adversaries know this, and they have invested heavily over the years to try to undermine our advantage. And in a lot of ways, our EW capabilities had atrophied over the years, and we're changing that around. We're making them more robust as we go forward. So those are the problem set areas that I'm going to continue to focus on.
In addition to your subcommittee, and this is an area the AOC has worked a lot with your office, you also have a leading role in three very important caucuses to the Cybersecurity, Directed Energy Caucus, and then the EW Working Group, which basically allows you to lead on each of these issues from a caucus standpoint. But what role, as a subcommittee chair, what role do some of these caucuses play or can play in terms of advancing the issue in Congress or raising awareness?
Yeah. So, all three of these areas are vital to national security and initiatives, but, not necessarily well understood by lawmakers and their staffs. And so the role of the caucus is basically to educate lawmakers and staff and garner support for these programs. I know that we sponsored two DE caucuses, caucus events this year. We had program updates and DE weapons and in the strategic context. And it allows us to advocate for policies to push the DoD to develop and field these new technologies. So, all three are vital to national security. And I was proud to lead or co-lead all three of them.
Hello, everyone. I want to take a short break to thank Battelle for their continued support for our From the Crow's Nest podcast. It's always great to hear from them, and I am pleased to be here with Rusty Colemorgan, Navy veteran and division manager at Battelle. Rusty, thanks for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks very much, and thanks for the opportunity.
You've had an interesting career with extensive stints in the Navy and industry. What brought you to Battelle, and how does your experience align with Battelle's mission?
Yeah, thanks for that, Ken. And I did have a very rewarding career as a Navy pilot. And as I transitioned through a number of companies in industry, I continue to have great experiences because I got the chance to work alongside eye-watering technical talent. What I'm most excited about at Battelle is how our campus is literally surrounded by an impressive depth of relevant applied researchers. That uniquely embedded in-house research capability serves as a foundation as we focus on solutions to the world's hardest problems. We strive to create a better world through science, and the RavenStar technology is the latest example of a hard problem with wide society benefits.
In the past, we've heard here on From the Crow's Nest from your colleagues, Doug Thornton and Molly Engel. They provided some intriguing insights about the RavenStar antenna. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about the challenges of this trade space and what you're trying to address with this game-changing technology?
Well, the bottom line is that users have had to sub-optimize their capabilities and needs with traditional design approaches in the RF spectrum. Traditionally, electronic warfare and command and control users want a number of capabilities that create a challenging design space. Those needs are typically long ranges, maximum throughput, and low probability of intercept, low probability of detection. They want those ranges for more effective operational reach or standoff, and They want more throughput for the increased data that leads to actionable intelligence. And those tight control of the emissions, they want those for either maximizing energy on a particular bearing or limiting the ability to detect or interfere with their emissions. It's not an easy trade space, but the flexibility of the Ravenstar architecture gives them more of what they want operationally.
So what does Ravenstar do that makes it optimized across these critical performance needs, and how does that stand out from traditional approaches?
Well, our frequency agility gives operators flexibility to work an ultra-wide portion of the spectrum through a single low-swap software-defined aperture. Ravenstar co-designed extremely wide-band aperture arrays with co-located advanced electronics. And this allows a compact, frequency-flexible RF solution. Our approach minimizes conventional antenna feature trade-off and allows significant design flexibility for delivering the spectrum dominance that's needed.
We've been tracking this program here on the show. How mature is Ravenstar today?
We put it at a TRL 6 after testing that we've done in December of 2023, and continuing into this year, we'll do field tests, accompanying lab demonstrations, and development performance on formal efforts with different DoD customers, all that are pointed toward a continued maturation of the Ravenstar design. They show the Ravenstar's ability is to support all domain missions that require multiple communications.
Well, thank you, Rusty, for joining me here on the show. It's always great to hear from the Patel team. And now it's time to get back to our show.
So I just wanted to talk a little bit about directed energy, too. You've been following this for many years, and you've seen kind of the growth of this area as it's really starting to enter operations. Can you talk about where we're at today with directed energy, and where are we succeeding, and what are some of the challenges we have moving forward?
I grew up in the Reagan era, right? And I still remember the famous Strategic Defense Initiative speech. And, you know, Ronald Reagan did what presidents do, right? They, you know, they set out this bold vision and, you know, the directed energy missile defense shield that was going to protect the United States from ICBM attacks from the Soviet Union. Now, at the time, it turned out there was a lot of hype and that the technology was not nearly mature enough at all to even come close to that vision. But it did rally, you know, our greatest, you know, our bright scientists and military thinkers to move in that direction. So, you know, here I am all these years later, and directed energy is really coming into its own. It's maturing at a rapid pace, and it's currently really at an inflection point. The technology is mature, and it's showing real operational benefits, especially against drones. It's already been demonstrated, but that's a small mindset in some ways that fixes today's problems. You know, this is where Congress really needs to step in and help. We need to convince the services that DE is the way of the future. It's the way forward for things like missile defense, defending the fleet, all our ships, our sailors, and Marines. And we need to get these systems fielded across the military services. So this is what, you know, we're focusing on. We want to get the technology over the valley of death, if you will, because it can be a game changer. Enemies and adversaries investing in things like hypersonics and also, you know, short, medium, and long range missiles that they can hold us and our forces, fleet at risk. We need to change that around. You know, these and the, you know, obviously the kinetic interceptors are very expensive. If we can utilize directed energy, we're talking about pennies per shot versus millions per shot. So we definitely bend the cost curve in our favor and just enhance our capabilities across the spectrum.
But you mentioned the Valley of Death, and you know, I think one of the challenges that I've seen with directed energy over the years is, you know, it's has a very strong track record in the labs, but when you really get into operationalizing directed energy, you have to deal with what we call like the dot mil PF, the doctrine, organization, leadership, the training, the personnel. There's a lot that goes into operationalizing the capability. How is DoD positioned on that front? Do you think, what role do you think Congress has in working with DoD to make sure that, you know, we have the manpower, we have the training, the skill set, the policy and doctrine, all that to support really pushing DE into the future and operationalizing it?
But you raise a good point, right? Because you have to field the equipment. You got to get into the hands of the warfighter, let them work with it. You got to incorporate it into our CONOPS and a number of the planning and how you incorporate it and as a complement other technologies. So the services really need to incorporate DE systems into future design plans. They need to articulate operational plans, identify and employ DE capabilities. So the Navy has a promising start. by mentioning the need to design future ships around DE systems. But we've already seen that it's not just a science project anymore. This has real utility for shooting down drones. We've already done it in real world tests. I was excited when they put the first laser demonstrator on the USS Ponce. It's only a 30 kilowatt system. It's not, suitable for missile defense, but, it showed utility, shooting down low flying or slow flying planes or drones. And then you've got the 150 kilowatt system that's being put on the USS Ponce. And so there again, when you get into the 150 to 300 kilowatt range, you're talking about utility for things like ship defense, missile defense, and it's exciting. We're at the cutting edge.
Providing full spectrum superiority across all domains, that's defining possible. Giving warfighters the freedom to act across the spectrum, especially in highly contested battle spaces, can seem impossible. At Northrop Grumman, we've pushed the boundaries of possible across the spectrum for decades. Today, our cutting edge, interoperable, multifunction technologies are a revolutionary leap in spectrum dominance. How revolutionary? Imagine detecting the precise location of an adversary long before they ever detect you. Or better yet, denying or degrading an adversary's system without them being able to do a thing about it. Your freedom to shape the spectrum is an overwhelming advantage in every domain. An advantage made possible by Northrop Grumman's unique software-defined, open, safe, secure architecture solutions. It's all part of our commitment to ensure our warfighters have full spectrum dominance to make real-time decisions, no matter the environment. That's defining possible. Learn more at ngc.com/EW.
I want to shift our focus to electromagnetic spectrum operations. The subcommittee had a hearing featuring Brian Clark from Hudson Institute and Dr. Connolly from Mercury, as well as GAO. It raised a lot of issues about where DoD is going in terms of governance and fielding capabilities. What were some of the takeaways that you had from that hearing back in March?
Well, I think some of the takeaways were that DoD has made significant progress in closing gaps and in our EW capabilities and maintaining advantages. Obviously, more work needs to be done in things like modernizing systems and capabilities, joint interoperability, develop right management structure, strategy, and resources in DoD. But, we're showing steady progress there, and I want to make sure that we continue to stay on the right path.
The GAO testified, they had a report back in December and testified on that at the hearing. And they mentioned that basically, in the past, we have the DoD EMS superiority strategy out that's currently, they're getting ready to release the implementation plan for that. But DoD's history with effectively implementing strategies is a little bit up for debate. They haven't always done a good job, particularly on the EW front. What can Congress do? What are some of the things that Congress can do or the Armed Services Committee, your subcommittee can do to hold DoD accountable to fully implementing the EMS superiority strategy?
Well, first of all, we can put a single office in charge. Congress has already taken the first step by directing DoD to find a single entity to be responsible for EMSO. Ideally, it's a policy person, but we also need to resource that office appropriately. Those are the things that I'm going to continue to focus on this session of Congress and beyond.
You mentioned earlier when we were talking about directed energy, the Valley of Death, that's getting programs from R&D over to procurement is a very important issue. And kind of related to that is also how we diversify the limited resources we have on key capabilities. You can only fund so much. We have the new budget coming out, the FY 2022 budget request coming out hopefully soon, and of course, Congress's role in developing the annual authorization bill. How can Congress help DoD invest in future EMSO technologies, diversify that into some of the capabilities that you've talked about today?
Yeah, so basically, we need flexible, agile systems that are software-centric. Historically, we've been hardware-focused, while the software is kind of an afterthought. That needs to change. We need interoperability between new and existing platforms, and we need to leverage innovation in the private sector wherever possible. So, things that are plug and play, if you will, allowing for software upgrades, flexibility, these are the things that, what we need to focus on in the future. That's not the way it is right now, but we're going to change that.
During the rounds of questions with the other members of the subcommittee, one of the topics that I was pleased to hear come up so frequently was that on kind of workforce and STEM and education, that aspect of the issue, because I think oftentimes we just look at just the technology and we forget about the people behind it that are making that technology and have to operate it and learn it. So how do we improve education, training, and sustainment programs for an EMSO workforce, skilled engineers, physicists, programmers, and operators?
Well, you're spot on to focus on workforce, because it's not only about the developing the technology, but it's about the people that are doing the research and development and then ultimately using the technology. So we've got to invest more in career and technical education programs, so CTE, through all levels of schooling to create a technical workforce with EMSO understanding. And we need to attract and retain foreign talent as well. So one of the things I've put forward and hoping to see progress in getting it into the NDAA this year is the National Security Innovation Pathway Act. And that would allow the Secretary of Defense to designate certain areas that are important to national security and put them the people that, after they've worked hard and they've studied here, that put them on a path to citizenship, so we keep that talent here in the United States. But, we need public and private sector competitiveness. Attracting talent to work in government is a matter of national security. We lose talented people due to bureaucratic barriers like security clearances. So need to change that and need to really upskill the current talent, encourage service members and DOD civilians to take AI and coding and programming and cybersecurity courses, that we leverage that talent, grow that talent in the military going forward.
And a lot of that also has to get into our schools, high school, college, through STEM programs and other, private sector, public sector partnerships. Is this something you're looking into, is how to kind of improve or facilitate these STEM partnerships and opportunities to really get some of the young people that have the ability to really dive into this this technical matter very early on and get them trained up? What are some of the things that we can do to kind of help out the STEM partnerships out there?
So definitely growing this talent at the youngest ages is important. So that's, again, a big believer in career and technical education programs, K-12 education. And you look at defense and commercial sector partnerships, we're most effective when the two sectors collaborate on training a skilled workforce. The submarine industrial base, really epitomizes this model. We're going to have to hire 17,000 new skilled workers for the Columbia-class program. The Navy, Congress, and private industry, I know right now, are working together to set up that training pipeline today, and it's going to impact us well into the future.
You mentioned the NDAA and Congress. Obviously, the committee is starting its annual defense budget process, but we're still, of course, waiting for the official president's request of the budget, which I assume is going to be coming here in a few weeks. Can you talk to us a little bit about what is the process going to look like moving forward here? What is the subcommittee schedule, or what is the committee schedule for addressing the FY 2022 defense budget?
Yeah, right now, we'd be in the middle of posture hearings. That's what we were expecting we would be, but we don't have the budget yet, so it's a little difficult to do posture hearings without a budget. Yeah, we're hoping to get the president's budget soon, and then Secretary Austin testifying before Congress coming up in a few weeks. And then, moving forward, it's going to be about the doing the mark of the NDAA, but we're looking at probably, we're talking July or perhaps even September before we actually get to markup. So it's going to be a little later than usual.
Yeah, that's quite a bit unprecedented, but I mean, this is obviously every year is a little bit different. I don't believe it's ever been that late for quite a while, at least.
Yeah, I can't remember being that late either. We're going to have to just adapt and push through.
With that, there's been a lot of conversation looking forward. Obviously, we're coming out of this COVID new reality and a lot of other competing priorities for limited federal resources. And there's already been talk, about not being able to continue the growth in defense spending that we've experienced in the years past. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be significant cuts. But there is going to have to be some contraction probably in the future years. What are some of the areas that you think Congress and DOD need to focus on that can help us bridge this uncertainty between potentially contracting a defense budget, but also meeting the requirements for future warfare?
There's no doubt that defense budgets will likely be under pressure in coming years. But, you know, I think we just have to get smarter about how we're spending our defense dollars, make sure we're getting the best capabilities, you know, at an appropriate cost. And, you know, HASC is going to have to, military will have to divest from legacy systems that are not effective in great power competition. Just by way of example, the Marine Corps decommissioned its tank battalions and invested in naval strike missiles. So the city subcommittee, the city incorporate commercial off-the-shelf technology where we can. We're going to update our software acquisition policies to accelerate and improve how the DoD acquires software. And, you know, even as the budgets remain flat, we can't stop though investing in emerging technology. Bottom line is, if we don't figure it out, you know, our adversaries will. Emerging technologies like AI or quantum, they're going to be game changers in cyber and space and the spectrum domains. So we've got to make sure that you know, these technologies are harnessed by us, developed, and that, you know, we maintain our competitive and qualitative edge.
One of the policies of the new Biden administration as it pertains to the defense budget is the effort to bring overseas contingency operation funding, OCO funding, back into the base budget. They've been separated for almost 20 years. And basically, OCO funding has been separate from any effort to either balance the budget or keep defense spending to a certain cap level. I think it's good that we actually are bringing this back together so we have more accountability and transparency in the budget. I wanted to get your take on this idea of bringing OCO and base budget back together.
Yeah, I definitely, we should make every effort to do just that. OCO, I think, has been too often used as a fund to, you know, get things in that weren't in the base budget. And I think bringing it back together into mainstream budget is a better way to go looking forward.
I want to thank you for joining me for the episode. I really greatly appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. It's been a great discussion, and I appreciate your interest in all these topics and look forward to future conversations.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. That will conclude this episode of From the Crow's Nest. Thank you, Congressman Langevin, for joining us. AOC appreciates all the hard work you do in Congress. I also want to thank our episode sponsor, Northrop Grumman Corporation. Northrop Grumman's multifunction interoperable solutions create full-spectrum superiority for our warfighters across all domains. Learn more at ngc.com/EW. And finally, this week, From the Crow's Nest is set up here at our AOC SEMA 2021 conference. We are currently working on a special episode of interviews with speakers and exhibitors that we will be releasing next week. We also have a much anticipated release of our sister podcast, The History of Crows, coming out on June 2nd. Please join us for these special episodes. And as always, thank you for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by Battelle, the world's largest independent, not-for-profit, applied science and technology organization. Since 1929, their mission has been to translate scientific discovery and technology advances to benefit society. Through markets such as health, environment, infrastructure, industry, and national security, Battelle has been delivering cutting-edge solutions that impact the well-being of the world and help keep us safe at home. To learn more, go to battelle.org/connect. That's BATTELLE.org/connect.